country music takes center stage. Filmmaker Ken Burns' latest much-anticipated project began airing Sunday night. I was standing by the window. Country music looks at the genesis and growth of a uniquely American art form. On Sunday and Monday night, viewers learned how the confluence of different musical instruments and traditions created the distinctive early sound of banjo, fiddle, and guitar, and how the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers emerged as country music's first megastars, reflecting different values in the country as well as music. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we talk with series producer and writer Dayton Duncan about this ambitious project. And a little later in the show, Ken Burns joins us to discuss the evolution of country music and what it means to America. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Country music is a uniquely American art form, and it is the subject of the latest Ken Burns documentary that began airing on PBS this past Sunday. On the line with me right now, Dayton Duncan. He is one of the producers of this 8-part series, the main writer and producer of the series. He has worked with Ken Burns as a writer and producer of documentary films for nearly 30 years. Ken will join us later in the program. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you been watching the documentary? Is there a country music song, story, or connection you would like to share? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or as always, post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dayton, thanks so much for joining us today, and congratulations on the project.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer. I hope you remember there's still 6 more episodes to go.
Oh, yeah. So tonight and Wednesday, and then next Sunday through Wednesday as well, correct?
That's it.
All right. Well, take me back a decade or so. Tell me about your original conversation with Ken about this idea to do a big series about country music. He came to you, right?
Yeah, a friend of his in Texas had asked him, why haven't you done a film on country music? And he thought about that for a little bit and called me up. He and I were planning a different big series for this time, around this time to come out. And he called me up and said, my friend Cappy just said, we ought to think about country music. What do you think? And I said, I think it's a great idea as long as I'm the one that writes and produces it.
And why did you say that, right? How did you know right off the top this was going to be one of these opportunities of a lifetime?
Well, I think for both Ken and me, it was a little bit, why haven't we already done this? It's, you know, of the films that we do, which is an exploration of American history and who we are as a people, country music is just a great prism, just like the national parks was, or you know, many of the other series that we do, a way of looking at that history. You know, I compare it to, you're going past the same scenery in a different train each time, and you know the perspective that you get on it is a little bit different, and it deepens your understanding of the whole landscape. I grew up listening to country music. I've written some country songs just for my own edification and try to woo the woman who became my wife. It's been a labor of love for me.
Well, I can only imagine that when you got started on this project 8.5 years ago, it was quite something just to get your head around the topic. And to start with, you had to define country music. What is country music?
Well, I think what we learned pretty early on in the exploration of its history and its roots and is that it sort of defies a simple definition. I mean, the great songwriter Harlan Howard defined it as 3 chords and the truth. And I think there is some validity to that in the sense that melodically it's not generally very complex. 3 chords. The truth part, that's where it gets complex and profound. And what we learned right at the very start, what I learned as I started the research on it, is that it never was just one style of music. It was always this amalgam of different styles coming together in a great American way. That's who we are, and that's why it exemplifies who we are. It's a mongrel, and it's a mix of the Irish Celtic ballads and English hymns and African American blues and work songs and minstrel songs, all those things that came together to create what we now call country music. And in that mix, and over the course of the 20th century, it sprouted many new branches that are all under the umbrella of country, but don't sound necessarily alike. You know, last night we saw Bob Wills taking what was the big band sound and instead applying a steel guitar and fiddles to it and create Western swing. And tonight you'll see Bill Monroe taking the old string band music and syncopating it and energizing it with the help of Earl Scruggs and Lester Flatt and others to create bluegrass music. And tomorrow night you'll see, you know, what was called at the time hillbilly music reconnecting with gospel and rhythm and blues. And the offshoot of that in Memphis, Tennessee, was what was called rockabilly, the precursor to rock and roll. And then you get the Bakersfield sound out with, you know, Merle Haggard and Buck Owens in later episodes, and the smooth Nashville sound, and Willie and Waylon and the outlaw sound. It's always been this. It sort of defies a simple embrace because it reaches out to touch other forms of music, and it pulls other forms of music in, and it affects other forms of music.
Did you have any preconceived notions going into the project that were just completely blown to bits?
I think what we try to do in every film that we make is, regardless of what we think we know about it, we try to strip ourselves of any presumptions or stereotypes or anything, and say we take a long time to do these things. And one of the results of that, deliberately so, is we allow the story to tell itself to us and what needs to be told. So, you know, I was familiar with a number of the country, great country figures, but in investigating their lives, every place I turn, there's an incredible story about how a certain song got written. Or just the life story of some of these great stars themselves are just amazing, and things I certainly didn't know. But I think the main thing that struck me was what I said earlier, is that everybody has their own preconception of what they think country music is, whether they like it or whether they think that they hate it. And what I learned right off is that you've got to understand that it is much broader than you ever thought it was.
Well, we have someone joining us now who knows a little something about music. Spencer Albee is a Portland area musician, singer, songwriter, friend of the show. Hi, Spencer.
How's it going?
I understand you just launched a new podcast, Spencer Explores the Universe.
That's true.
Well,
true.
Good.
I'm trying my hand at talking into a microphone.
I have a feeling you're pretty good at that. Spencer Albee, I understand your grandfather makes a small appearance in the documentary.
Yeah, as fate would have it, my mom called at a time that was kind of alarming for, you know, because you'd think that they'd be in bed already. So I naturally picked up, and she was so excited because there was a still of my grandfather and his brother in episode one.
Tell us about it.
Full disclosure, I haven't had the time to watch the series. I'm very keen to, because it's a topic that I'm interested in, and I will watch it soon. But the context was a still of used to kind of illustrate that this sound that was happening down south was catching on in the north in its own way. And he was my grandfather and his brother were both vaudeville musicians, and they would ride the train from Rochester, New Hampshire, down to Boston to play as kids. And they both played banjos, and you know, this footage and these photographs of them have popped up before, and my mom actually saw it on a Quaker Oats commercial when I was younger, where it was like a what's hot Quaker Oats, what's not, my grandfather playing his banjo, you know, what's hot, you know, Quaker Oats is hot, and then what's not hot is, you know, the guy with the aluminum wings jumping off his barn, that kind of thing. So this is a much more, it's a way better gig for my grandfather to be in a Ken Burns documentary, I think.
That's so fun. Before we let you go, Spencer, who are some of your biggest country music influences? I mean, everybody knows how you feel about the Beatles. What about country music?
Yes, I don't like the Beatles, and I've made that widely known. Country music has also been part of my my upbringing, and it's in the air. Willie Nelson, Dolly Parton, Patsy Cline, Johnny Cash, Glen Campbell, Roger Miller's a big one for me. And it's always the, you know, the simplicity of the music, as was earlier stated, yes, like melodically simple, but also the complexity of the lyrics and how it's almost like with stand-up comedians, the perfect joke uses the least amount of words. And I would say that's also true with country music lyrics. You can say a great number of things that have, you know, some pretty, so have weight to them by using very few words. And that's one of my favorite parts of country music, is how clever the lyricist can be sometimes to paint a picture with just a sentence.
Well, Spencer, I hope you tune in, because all those people you mentioned that are your lodestars have big appearances. You know, Dolly and Willie, Patsy Cline tomorrow night. We tell her story, and obviously the tragic end of it. But I think you hit on another thing, which is, in my mind, country music at its best takes this invisible art of music, which can penetrate without directly to your heart, and it combines it with poetry, which is the distillation of our language, to deal with the most universal human emotions and human experiences. And when you combine that good poetry and that good melody, you have a delivery system, a 3-minute delivery system that embeds itself in your heart.
Yeah, it's a very relatable human message in great country music, and I think that's why it spans, I mean, decades and decades. So I am looking forward to the show, and I'm sorry I haven't watched it yet. But.
Well, Spencer, thanks so much for calling in. Spencer Albee, Portland-based singer-songwriter. He is the man behind the annual event Beatles Night, and he has a new podcast called Spencer Explores the Universe. You know, Dayton, Spencer said, you can get a lot of weight into just a few words, and I'm going to play a clip that that illustrates that. This is from the film, and this is a little bit with Loretta Lynn.
It was quickly followed by another song from a wife's perspective, only this time aimed at a husband who stumbles home drunk, expecting sex.
You thought that I'd be waiting up when you came home last night. You'd been out with all the boys and you ended up half-tight. Liquor and love, they just don't mix, leave the bottle or me behind. And don't come home but drinking with loving on your mind. That's how it goes.
No, don't come home with drinking.
The same year that the National Organization for Women was founded, and the year the phrase women's liberation was first used, Don't Come Home a Drinkin' with Lovin' on Your Mind became Loretta Lynn's first number one hit. She didn't consider herself part of any movement, nor did her growing legions of female country music fans. But they believed that at last someone was speaking for them.
They were going to do the same thing.
So a clip from the new documentary series, Country Music. Its producer, Dayton Duncan, is with us right now. Dayton, Spencer was talking about just a few words. Don't come home a-drinkin' with lovin' on your mind. I mean, not just a turn of phrase that people can relate to, but also a little bit of history there.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be in our fifth episode, which airs this coming Sunday. And, you know, as Elvis, we interviewed people we interviewed 101 people for this. Most of them, you know, in country music, one historian, Bill Malone, but some people also from outside of country music. In that, following in that clip is Elvis Costello saying, you know, nobody in any musical genre was writing about that kind of stuff, you know, which is alcoholism, spousal abuse, a woman's right to her body in rock and roll certainly wasn't, and no other form was, but there was Loretta, you know, speaking the truth and connecting with people. She says later in that clip, you know, women who are going through the same thing would put the record, they'd see their husband coming home late at night and they'd put that record on just to make the point. She's one of a lot of really, really incredible and strong women that populate, I think, the whole history of country music.
And, you know, that's one of the interesting things to me, because so many people think of country music as being more traditional, more conservative than other types of music. But you have looked at the history of other genres of music, and really women were more important earlier than in other genres.
Yeah, well, the two of the sort of the foundational acts of country music, once it started being recorded and aired over the radio in the 1920s, were the Carter family, and that's A.P. Carter, his wife Sarah, and her cousin Maybelle. Maybelle Carter's the first great guitarist in country music. Sarah's voice was what carried it. You know, A.P. collected songs, but when they performed, he was sort of standing in the background. You know, they were front and center. Rose Maddox of the Maddox Brothers and Rose, she was a terrific force. Kitty Wells, and then you get to Loretta, and then you get to Dolly Parton, and then you get to, you know, on and on and on. Reba McEntire. They've been front and center throughout the history of country music.
Well, speaking of women, and before we go to our first break, Dayton, somebody told me that one of your favorite country music songs is Emmylou Harris's Boulder to Birmingham. Tell me why.
Oh, well, it just touches my heart. It's a beautiful melody. It is just heart-wrenching. And as I learned, with any great song, you don't need the backstory. That's not what makes it a great song, is knowing the backstory. It communicates in and of itself. But as I learned, and as we were making the film, Boulder Birmingham was something that she co-wrote after the death of her mentor in country music, the rock and roller / rock country star Graham Parsons.
Mm.
And it melts me every time I hear it.
Well, we're going to melt you going into the break. Here's Emmylou Harris, Boulder to Birmingham. This is Maine Calling. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from AARP Maine, working to lower prescription drug costs. Learn more at aarp.org/rx.
Almost a third of all African elephants were killed by poachers between 2007 and 2014. Now a park in Malawi is using an artificial intelligence program to predict where poachers might be before a shot is ever fired.
Yeah, you can do a lot more preemptive stuff. We pick up trends, we pick up patterns.
Can AI save the elephants? That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. The United Nations Climate Action Summit takes place in New York next week. This week, more than 250 news outlets from around the world, including both NPR and Maine Public News, are taking part in a series called Covering Climate Now. Throughout this week, you'll hear stories on climate news and issues. On Maine Public Radio, you'll hear the reporting on Morning Edition, Here and Now, and All Things Considered. Maine Calling takes a look at rising sea levels this Friday. More information is at mainepublic.org/climate. Now.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about the new PBS documentary, Country Music. It's an 8-part series. It began Sunday on Maine Public Television. It runs this week until Wednesday. Then parts 5 through 8 air next Sunday through Wednesday. You can visit our website for more information. You can also see it on PBS Passport. On the line with us is one of the film's producers, Dayton Duncan. He has worked with Ken Burns as a writer and producer of documentary films for nearly 30 years. And speaking of Ken Burns, he will be on the line with us in just a minute. You know Ken is the producer and director of numerous film series, including the Vietnam War, the Roosevelts, and Jazz. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Dayton, I'm going to go to an email from Marty. He says he loves the series. Does he think Lucinda Williams' Car Wheels on a Gravel Road album was a major influence?
Well, you know, we stop our narrative in 1996, so we don't really get it. This is a spoiler alert for your emailer. I love Lucinda Williams, and her songs are great. We can't cover everybody, and so he won't be hearing that, I'm sorry to say.
So why did you decide to stop in 1996?
Well, you know, Jennifer, we're not journalists. We deal with history, and by very definition of that, you need an arm's length, about a generation's at least, distance from the topic in order to make the really hard decisions you got to make. You know, we also are storytellers. It's not an encyclopedia, just a list of names and a KTEL commercial of 3 seconds of a song. We like to tell the story of the artists. We like to tell the story behind a number of the songs. And for each artist that we cover, each song that we highlight, each moment that we linger over, there's probably 10 or 20 others that we can't. So we need that distance. And so 96, there's a lot of things going on by that point. Garth Brooks has burst onto the scene, taking, you know, the popularity of country music to stratospheric heights. The great patriarch of bluegrass music, Bill Monroe, dies. There's a change in the telecommunications law that has a profound effect on the playlists of what's, with the consolidation of ownership of, you know, constricting the playlists of what's being heard. And also Johnny Cash, who's a major figure in our film, starting in the fourth episode, Tomorrow Night, and on through the eighth, had been dropped by his label unceremoniously, but he's brought back by, of all things, a hip-hop producer, Rick Rubin, brought into a studio, not to create a hip-hop record, but to sing just simple songs of his own choosing with just him, his extraordinary voice, and his guitar, and that resurrected his career and sort of, in his own mind, redeemed his place, and that seemed like a good place to stop. I mean, you know, you could have gone to 97, 98, I suppose, as well, but we need that, you know, 20-25 year gap in order to do the history that we make.
We're joined now by Ken Burns, the director of the film. Hi, Ken. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Hey, partner.
Hey, buddy.
You know, Ken, before you joined us in the first section of this program, Dayton was explaining how the films that you all make together are American history, but it's the same landscape, different terrain. And I'm wondering, how do you think the view of out the country music window of that train is different than the view you've seen before?
Well, it's very interesting because we've certainly been through this territory, that is to say the 20s through the end of the century, many, many times in many different films, or certainly through the sweet spot of the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, so many times. And each time it's completely different. And I think it's just because you've got to focus on country music. You see the Depression from a little bit different angle, because you're focused more on the music and not the policy people. You see it, you see the 20s and the jazz age from a different point of view, because you're focusing on country music and not the jazz per se, and the gangsters and the flappers and all of the things that are part of that. It's wonderful, it's refreshing, and it tells you that more often than not, when you say the 20s to somebody, there's a kind of superficial kind of idea that you have. And every time we go through it and we see it from a different angle, it explodes that. And you understand, as Harry Truman is supposed to have said, that the only thing that's really new is the history you don't know.
Hmm. I want to talk to both of you, Dayton and Ken, about the treatment of race in country music, but also in your film. Modern day contemporary country music world is come under criticism a lot for being too exclusive, having too much of a white redneck reputation. And I'm going to run a clip from the film and then have you all discuss reality versus perception.
By the 1920s, as minstrel shows were fading, Ralph Peer recorded Emmett Miller, still appearing in blackface, singing Lovesick Blues, to which he added a distinctive yodeling break. Like so much other music of the time, it drew deeply from so-called race music, even if that music was performed almost exclusively by whites, most of them Southerners.
The South itself is a place of black and white Southerners. I mean, there's no white South. It's not Scandinavian. It is a place where black and white people live cheek by jowl, as we say. And the influences go back and forward.
You have the cultures coming together, and whenever you have these contradictions together in the South,
Ken, Dayton, that's from early on in the film. We've already seen that if you're watching the documentary film. Do you think it will come as a surprise to people that country music's roots are really so multicultural?
I think they will. I think it is interesting. It was new to me that the banjo is from Africa, and just as the fiddle is from the British Isles and Europe. And that is what America is about. Everything is a mixture. Everything is an alloy. Everything is stronger because of its constituent parts. And we tend, and particularly today, to sort of, in a binary world and a media culture, isolate these things. And sometimes our politicians suggest that what's really, truly American is you need to pull out this one thing. But of course, if you pull something out of an alloy, you weaken it and make it more brittle and less strong. And so I think one of the great things about country music is that it deals with race, because race is ever American narrative. It isn't something that we treat, it's there. And we are not unmindful, nor do we not chart all the indignities of the race issue that has bedeviled the American narrative since 1619, 400 years ago this year. But at the same time, we are also inclusive about the inclusiveness of country music, that it has so many roots, and many of those roots are African-American. We always labor to rid country music of its stereotype that it's one thing. And I think we prove very well that it's always been more than one thing, and each one of those things are themselves an amalgam of many other things. So the Carter family has an African-American man, Leslie Riddle, who travels with A.P. Carter to song collect. He introduces them to a gospel song, When the World's on Fire. They take the melody and turn it into their hit, Little Darlin' Pal of Mine. And Woody Guthrie then takes that same melody and does This Land Is Your Land. This is the story of America. You can call it appropriation, but when you see, after you see that Johnny Cash and Bill Monroe and Hank Williams also had African-American mentors, and that Jimmy Rogers, the music's first superstar, was steeped in the blues because he was a water boy on an African-American train crew laying track in southern Mississippi. But it runs both ways, because you find out in this film that Ray Charles, when he's given creative control of an album for the first time, records, much to the surprise of his own folks, modern sounds in country and Western music. And the number one single of the summer of 1962 was I Can't Stop Loving You, a country song by Don Gibson. And if you listen to it, it's still a country song, just happens to be sung by a soul singer who said, you take country music and you take black music, and it's the same GD thing every time. And all we have to do is transpose ourselves to the present moment with Lil Nas X, which is about storytelling, and lots of references to the previous album. You know, rappers are very... That's a really wonderful tradition in country music, too. Kitty Wells has a wonderful single called God Didn't Make Honky Tonk Angels. And you could say you could take rap music and you could take country music, and it's the same GD thing. And I think we are not unmindful of the indignities, but we also...
Oh, gosh, Ken, I think we've lost you for a little bit. I hope we can get you back. I'm looking over at our... Oh, there you go. Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is Dayton. Just as a note, Hank Williams, we cover him in tonight's episode, what you'll learn is that his first really breakthrough hit was Lovesick Blues, which had, you know, become popular by Emmett Miller, which was also, it also been, it also has its own African-American roots. And, Williams says a street musician by the name of Rufus T. Tot Payne in Alabama said all the music education I ever got, I got from him. So it's just there. I mean, I think as Ken was saying, we didn't set out to try to make a point. We set out to tell the story as it actually unfolded. And you know, you cannot ignore that great connection between the the fiddle and the banjo in shorthand, between so-called white music and so-called black music. And in the early days, by commerce, they separated it into so-called race music, and what they originally called country music was hillbilly music. And in both of those terms that they were using, it exposed a prejudice, upper rungs of society could look down on either the race music or the hillbilly music. But in truth, both of those musics were dealing with real things and real music and real art. And that's what we've got today.
Ken mentioned Lil Nas X. I know this is not in the film because you end in 1996, but in case any listeners are wondering what we're talking about, we have a clip of that right now.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse through the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse through the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more.
I got the horses in the back.
Ken, are you there? Billy Cyrus with Lil Nas X.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is it. I mean, the idea that we could take a musical art form, which is necessarily restless and exploring, or take artists who need to push the boundaries of things and confine it into some, one thing, like country music was an island nation that you required a passport and a visa or relaxed immigration policies to get there, is completely fraudulent. It is always abutted jazz and blues and rhythm and blues, and with rhythm and blues, it's the parents of rock and roll, which it's connected to, and folk and pop and gospel and classical and now rap. So the fact that we're bordering on the country of rap is not only obvious, but I would suggest they're the same country and they're telling the same kinds of story about love, loss, and memory, and home, and falling in love and falling out of love, and all of the themes of popular music, however it might be manifested, is talking about the same story. I'm not at all shocked. I'm not at all unhappy. It's not in our film because it's in our film in every single episode. And so in many ways, Lil Nas X is the cherry on top of this cake that we proves the point that we've been making over the course of the previous 16 and a half hours.
So, Ken, before the last break, we went to one of Dayton's favorite country music songs, Emmylou Harris's Boulder to Birmingham. I understand one of your favorites is Roseanne Cash's I Still Miss Someone. Tell me about it.
It's Well, it's actually Johnny Cash's I Still Miss Someone, and it's a hugely important song to me in my life. I think it's hugely important in our film. It first catches up to us when Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan are playing it on the piano, and as Roseanne comments, it's clear that Bob knows the song a little bit better than Johnny. But towards the very end of our film, she ends up singing it one verse a cappella. It's four short verses, like exquisite haiku, with a beautiful, very simple, elegant melody. And she had to sing it at his memorial service at the Grand Ole Opry. And it's, I don't know if you see it in context and you don't have, and you're not crying, then I can't help you.
Okay, well, we'll listen to that as we go to a break. Roseanne Cash and Still Miss Someone.
At my door, the leaves are falling. The cold, wild winds will come. Sweethearts walk by together. 'Cause I still miss someone. I go out on a party and look for a little fun, but I find a dark in the corner. 'Cause I
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Farmland Trust, inviting you to Growing Together, a 20th anniversary celebration October 3rd at Broad Turn Farm in Scarborough. More at mainefarmlandtrust.org. By UMaine's Collins Center for the Arts, presenting Bobby McFerrin September 28th. Tickets at collinscenterforthearts.com. And Gracie Theater's Women of the World on October 13th, a celebration of diversity and the power of music. Gracie Theater.
Hello, I'm Jane Wales, host of World Affairs. Whether in person or in the news, people are seeing the tragedy of climate change unfold in the form of hurricanes, fires, or melting ice. Next on World Affairs, Caroline Hickman, executive committee member of the Climate Psychology Alliance, joins us to discuss the rise of climate anxiety and strategies for addressing it.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Heard enough news, love classical music? Perhaps our Maine Public Classical station is just what you need. Never heard about it? Maine Public Classical has a presence in seven areas around the state: Portland, Bangor, Waterville, also in western Maine in Fryeburg, on the southern coast around Booth Bay and Brunswick, one down east, and also now in many areas of York County. Where and how to find Maine Public Classical is at mainepublic.org. Classical music is timeless whenever you have the time. Maine Public Classical.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan. We're discussing their latest collaboration, Country Music, an 8-part series tracing the rise of country music. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You could also maybe squeeze in a quick email to talk@mainepublic.org. On the line with us now, Griffin Sherry. He plays guitar and is one of the singers in the successful Maine band Ghost of Paul Revere. Griffin, thanks for giving us a call.
Thanks for having me.
So when you think about country music, what artists come to mind? Who influenced you?
Well, I think, I kind of always grew up on the heavy hitters, people like Johnny Cash and Dolly Parton. But certainly I was given a copy of Will the Circle Be Unbroken by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Bands when I was in high school on vinyl. And that's what got me into bluegrass music and also started me down investigating country music kind of for myself, because I didn't really have a family that listened to country music at all. And that turned me on to people like the Carter Family and Marty Robbins and Conway Twitty and all these incredible people and writers throughout American history, and certainly Ray Charles. I know that record was just brought up, but modern sounds and country and Western music is such an immense piece of art that I fell in love with for sure in my first listen.
Griffin, hold on just a second, because we do have a clip from Will the Circle Be Unbroken, but this is not the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. This is the Carter Family. Dayton, tell us why this song and this version of the song is so important.
Well, this song is probably played more over the course of our 8 episodes than any other song. In fact, we end with it in our final episode, and we do cover in our 6th episode, Griffin, the whole story behind the Will the Circle Be Unbroken sessions with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, which, you know, brought a lot of people, including me, back to country. Can the Circle Be Unbroken is how the Carter family first phrased it. It was an old hymn. An African-American minister had retooled it a little bit, and then A.P. Carter retooled it even more. It's this incredible song because it points out what, I think the heart of country music. I'm standing by the window on a cold and cloudy day, and I saw that hearse come rolling for to carry my mother away. So you're thrown right there into the house. Mama's dead. You're going to follow the hearse and the casket out to bury her. And that's about as sad as you can get, right? But the chorus, will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by, there's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky, is a joyous chorus. And as Tricia Yearwood points out in one of our episodes, you know, everybody sings along on that part. So it's an important, bedrock song in the country music canon. And it keeps popping up at different points throughout our series.
All right. This is the Carter Family's original version.
I was standing by the window on one cold and cloudy day. And I saw the hearse come rolling for to carry my mother away.
Well, Griffin, Sherry, thanks for calling in, and thank you for mentioning that song. When does Coast of Paul Revere perform next around here?
We're just about to head out for about 2 months of national touring, but expect to see us for a couple shows in Maine, certainly around the holidays.
All right, and you've got a solo set coming up at the Thirsty Pig in Portland, right?
I do, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. That is Griffin Sherry, one of the three members of the Ghost of Paul Revere. Their latest record is Field Notes Volume 2, a compilation of covers and previously unreleased tracks and some live takes from last year's Ghostland. I want to read something that came in from our music host, a name that'll be familiar to everybody in Maine, Sarah Willis. She sent me an email, so sad she couldn't listen to the program today because she had an appointment, but she says, country music says too much about this country and what we have lost. Most importantly, our accepting of immigrants and their contribution to our culture. It's almost ineffable. Seeing and hearing those strings of the British Isles, Africa, Germany, Poland, Mexico, all come together to produce country music is profound. And then we have the wonderful joining of country and rock and roll. Ken, thoughts?
Well, I couldn't agree more. It said really well. I think that sometimes when you're down in the valley, it's hard to see the perspective, and we might be down in a valley, but I've got absolute confidence that, we'll be climbing up again on a rising road, and we'll be able to see those kind of vistas and understand kind of connections that, as I said, come from our strength as being an alloy, not a one thing, but a many thing. And I look forward to that day, and country music will be around to have appropriate songs for, as Charlie Pride says in our film, whatever mood you're in, and it may make you cry, but you'll feel better for crying.
Okay, well, we're going to go to a question from Clayton in Sangerville. Hi, Clayton, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I'm glad you mentioned Charlie Pride, because that was my question, was about, it's hard to think of too many African-American true country singers other than Charlie Pride. I'm sure there are others, but what kind of things did he have to endure when he was like breaking into country music along with some of the other greats like George Jones and others like that? Thanks.
Well, Clayton, Sunday when episode 5 is broadcast on your PBS station, because we go into great detail with it, and had a great interview with Charlie Pride talking about, you know, the prejudices that he faced, but also the friendships that he formed among the musicians. You know, it's an interesting thing that the musicians, being artists, understood this interconnectivity of our culture far ahead of the rest of the culture. So right in the midst of as the civil rights movement is happening, Charlie Pride, who has one of the most incredible voices in the history of country music, came and recorded for the first time in Nashville. And the record label was so skittish about a black country singer that when his first records came out, they didn't send a picture of him. And he tells this incredible story of one of his early concerts in Detroit, where when he's introduced, the thunderous applause, because they'd heard the record, came down to a whisper once he walked out on stage and they saw that he was black. But then he won them over by just performing for them. And, our first episode that aired on Sunday and followed up a little bit on last night also covered D. Ford Bailey, who was an African-American harmonica wizard, he was called. He was one of the big stars on the Grand Ole Opry. But the musicians are out ahead of the rest of us on these kind of things, I think. And Charlie Parker used to plug nickels into a jukebox in Manhattan and play Hank Williams songs, and his other bebop buddies would say, "Why are you listening to that kind of music?" And he said, "It's the stories. Listen to the stories." And so anyway, Charlie became the first black member of the Grand Ole Opry after D. Ford Bailey. So we don't whitewash the fact that there are these, large gaps there. But he also became the first artist of any color to win the CMA Award of Best Male Vocalist 2 years in a row.
And we do have a clip of D. Ford Bailey. This is Pan American Blues. Hearing the train come down the tracks. We're going to go to Felix calling from Milo. Hi, Felix. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm hearing a lot of white and black prejudice. How about the red? Now, I'm talking about Buffy St. Marie wrote the song that rattled me called Now That the Buffalo's Gone.
Okay. Is Buffy St. Marie somebody you all talk about, Ken, Dayton?
No, we don't. And I think that I would, unfortunately, even though I have professed these porous and open borders, and it's true, that I would put her, classify her more into folk. But the point is very well taken. And fortunately, country music has, among its patriarchs, a polymath of such wide and voracious interests and appetites, Johnny Cash, that he devotes an entire concept album and then spends a good time out on the road visiting reservations dedicated to the struggle and the sad struggle at that of Native Americans in this country. And so, what you have in Johnny Cash is not only one of the greats, up there on Mount Rushmore, without a doubt, with Loretta and Dolly and Jimmy Rogers and Hank Williams and Merle Haggard. And I've left out a few that should be up there too, but he's omnivorous in his curiosity about other kinds of music and other kinds of people, and particularly people who are dispossessed and downtrodden. So he's playing in prisons, he's going to reservations, he's everywhere doing that. And so I think our film has made room for that very excellent question that Felix has, but specifically to Buffy, not in this case. And let's remember that what we've made is not the reading of the telephone book. We're not a KTEL offer of all the country music songs ever written or a Time Life offer. We have to tell stories. And even at 16 and a half hours, we're going to be leaving out an awful lot of materials and we hope that the signal and emblematic stories that we do tell will be able to stand in for that moment when your favorite singer or perhaps your favorite version of their best country song isn't played in our film.
Well, I want to end this hour with Willie Nelson, because I understand, even though we've only seen two parts of the film so far, that one of the constants is how people who are seen as outsiders are sort of resisted at first, people who are pushing the envelope, and one of those is Willie Nelson. Dayton?
Oh, yeah. Willie's the best. We trace him as he called it, he was a great songwriter, but he was looked at in Nashville, as he called it, a loser singer. But when he went back to Texas, he found an audience there that appreciated his kind of music. And he said, hippies and redneck truck drivers would get together, enjoy the music, and learn that they don't really hate each other. And that's Willie. That's Willie all the way.
Well, it's been so fun to have you both here for the hour. Dayton Duncan is the voice you just heard. Also here, Ken Burns. They've worked together for nearly 30 years, and we have been discussing their latest collaboration, Country Music, an 8-part series on PBS, on Maine Public Television. We're going to keep Willie singing as we say thank you. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. For somebody new. Worry. Why do I let myself worry? Wondering what in the world did I do? I'm crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying. And I'm crazy for loving you. I'm crazy for thinking that my love could hold you.